They will need to find out what the actual temperature of the water is and what the quantity of the water is.
Assessing the geothermal potential at Mount Spur. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 13th of July. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, fire managers concentrate resources on a new wildfire north of Healy.
We've got two dozers there that are putting lines around subdivisions and doing what they can to protect the structures in the area.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The city of Bethel has settled a lawsuit with Yupik voters. The agreement will increase oversight of translation services during municipal elections. The state of Alaska is also named in the lawsuit, but is not included in the settlement. The Attorney General's office is ready to take the case to trial. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
It was 2007 when four elders sued the state of Alaska and the city of Bethel. Now the plaintiffs have reached a settlement with the city. Natalie Landreth with the Native American Rights Fund is one of their attorneys. She says the results of the settlement will be seen in the next election.
Elders who are primarily Yupik speakers who don't speak a lot of English will find it a lot easier to vote.
The consent decree will mandate that the city take certain steps for each election it runs. That includes training for bilingual translators, public service announcements in Yupik, and ballot propositions written in Yupik. Bethel City Clerk is in charge of running municipal elections. Lori Strickler fills that post. She says the agreement meets the needs of all Bethel voters in a way that the city can afford.
Both parties have worked together to ensure effective language translations.
Meanwhile, the case against the State Division of Elections is headed to trial. Federal District Judge Timothy Burgess has set a date for November 16th. According to Landreth, the trial could be the first of its kind in the country.
No state has fought its voters under Section 203 all the way through trial. Alaska will be the first one to do this.
The plaintiffs are alleging that the state is failing to meet its obligations as set forth in the Voters' Rights Act. Minority language provisions call on election jurisdictions to provide bilingual assistance in areas where a certain percentage of the population are non-English speakers. Since the lawsuit began, the state dramatically increased translation services in Yupik-speaking areas. But Landreth says their efforts fell short. She says her plaintiffs were pleased to see the changes, but her office received almost 40 complaints during the last election cycle.
A lot of the poll workers we found had been identified as translators, even though they themselves never offered to be a translator and weren't very comfortable serving as the translator based on their own knowledge of their skills. That's a problem.
The Native American Rights Fund and the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska are asking that the state allow federal observers to oversee polling locations. The state says that's a major sticking point towards reaching an agreement. Sarah Felix is an assistant attorney general for the state. She did not want to be recorded, but she says that the federal observers would be counterproductive. Felix says observers would be taken from the same pool of bilingual people qualified to work as translators at the polls. Judge Burgess has scheduled over a week for the trial. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Over the past few years, people who live along Alaska's rail belt have begun to worry about the lifespan of the system that delivers energy to their homes and businesses. A brighter future could be on the way through steps the legislature and the administration are taking to find alternatives. Their work is centering on new sources and on delivery of natural gas. But another renewable energy project is in the works, geothermal. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The technology needed to generate electricity from geothermal heat is no longer experimental. The designs and equipment are ready to go and are in place around the world. It's even in use in Alaska in small projects, but the possible development of a 100-megawatt facility on Mount Spur, across Cook Inlet from Anchorage, could make a major difference to the state's future energy needs. Ormat Incorporated is studying the potential of a plant on 36,000 acres on the slopes of the volcano. Ormat's the largest geothermal developer in the United States. The company's Paul Thompson has been part of several meetings in Alaska within the past few months.
Our end result is to develop a commercially viable geothermal power plant kind of in the foothills of Mount Spur. Our initial phase one goal is to develop a 50-megawatt geothermal plant. So a 50-megawatt plant is very large. And based on the geology and resource reports that we are going to do this summer, we hope that the resource will allow us to potentially expand that power plant to 100 megawatts later on. But our first goal is to build the first 50, get it online and operating, and then look towards an additional 50 later on.
The studies involve the terrain and the nature of the geothermal resources. They also are identifying the potential users of the low-cost baseload energy the project could produce. Thompson says Ormat recognizes that utilities base their initial decisions on price. Alaska's current royalty rate for geothermal production is 10%, while nationally, rates are between 2 and 3%. He says Ormat, or any other potential producer, has to provide energy at a price that's competitive with other power-generating sources.
Geothermal is very new to the state of Alaska, and we want to make sure that we are treated equitably along the other types of power producers. And so we are reviewing those provisions, and we're not looking to rewrite the entire law by any means. We're not looking to get any incentive that other energy producers don't get. We just want to make sure that they are equitable.
House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker has met with Ormat executives, and he says having the company willing to invest in Alaska is one of the best things the state could ask for. He recognizes the economic viability of the project, especially considering the competition that comes from state subsidies on other, more traditional sources of production. He says that 10% royalty would be added to consumer prices.
What we really need is to look at a specific project such as this one and identify what barriers that government can remove from them being able to go forward as a viable commercial entity, and whether that be facilitating permitting, whether that be setting up an appropriate tax structure, or whether that be allowing them some cost recovery tax credits under whatever tax structure they might be paying. All of these sort of things are discussions we need to be having as this project potentially goes forward.
Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell met with the Ormat representatives when they were in Alaska. He says he encouraged them to continue with the project, and he looks forward to hearing more from the company as their plans and needs become more specific. The advantage to geothermal energy is that it's a renewable resource being used around the world that's available nearly 100% of the time, unlike solar or wind facilities. Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project says the Ormat plans all hang on the results of the engineering studies that are going on now to determine the plant's capacity.
They will need to find out what the actual temperature of the water is and what the quantity of the water is. And so that 50 or 100 megawatt number is totally dependent on what the resource actually is, and we will know that after the exploration has been done. But certainly Ormat is putting a lot of their own money into this project because they believe that there's a good chance that the resource is there.
Rose says another advantage of Ormat's lead on Mount Spur is that it begins the infrastructure work needed for other renewable energy production from the same area. 330 megawatts from the hydroelectric potential of Lake Chacachamna, wind plants, and tidal resources that will become commercially viable. Ormat is not looking for any state direct assistance for the project. However, Thompson says it will welcome any assistance available for the infrastructure. If the studies and tests are successful, Ormat's plan would put power on the rail belt grid by 2016. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
To date, 393 forest fires this year have consumed more than 765,000 acres of Alaska wildlands. Fires burning on the Kenai Peninsula have destroyed more than 14,000 acres, while the Minto Flats fire near Fairbanks has burned more than 151,000 acres. Jennifer Juhas is a fire information officer with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center. She says three fires, Minto Flats South, Lunch Lake, and June Creek, are now being referred to as the Rail Belt Complex Fire and are being managed at one command center.
The most resources are working today on the June Creek fire because we have the best chance of catching this one while it's still small. The Minto Flats South fire is larger, but we're already looking at long-term scoping for that one.
There is a red flag warning in the June Creek area today, meaning low humidity and wind gusts could hamper firefighting efforts. She says there is concern about the more than 100 residences in the area, which is located south of Clear off the Parks Highway. Gary Lenhausen, also with AICC, says the Minto Flats fire is too big at this time to bring in more firefighting effort. Crews are attempting to hold it in place or divert it away from structures. A fire near historic McCarthy in the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve is growing fast and causing a lot of concern. According to Morgan Worthen with the National Park Service, plans are under consideration to fight the Chackina fire by igniting vegetation south of the Chittenden River to reinforce a defense zone that the river provides.
They would actually bring fire via a helicopter and use it to burn out fuels that are next to, or rather on the south side of the Chittenden River.
The burnout strategy is aimed at protecting historic sites and cabins on the other side of the river. Currently, 62 fires are active in Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau residents weigh in on where the next governor lives.
I'm confident that he'll reside in Juneau, where the governor should reside.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding on the web at GrantStation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
A report says Governor Sarah Palin's Political Action Committee raised nearly $733,000 in its first 5 months. A report filed Monday with the Federal Election Commission shows receipts totaled $732,867 in the period between January 1st and June 30th. The former GOP vice presidential candidate launched the committee, Sarah Pack, in late January, saying the goal was to help support candidates for federal and state office. The report says Sarah Pack made total disbursements of more than $276,000. Earlier this year, Palin announced she will resign as governor effective July 26, fueling speculation she will seek the presidency in 2012. Alaska's incoming governor says he will not move to the capital city full-time for the remainder of Governor Palin's term, but if he's elected in 2010, Sean Parnell says he will make Juneau his home. Since Palin took office in 2006, she has primarily lived in her own home in Wasilla and worked out of the Anchorage governor's office. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, Juneau residents are looking forward to the governor and the cabinet returning to the capital city.
Juneau Deputy Mayor Jeff Bush puts it this way.
Not like we've ever not been the capital, but we certainly haven't been treated like one under this administration.
The Palin family lived in the governor's house on Calhoun Street during the 2007 legislative session. Daughters went to Juneau schools. Then it was back to Wasilla. The first family never again returned to Juneau as residents, only as visitors. The state has paid Palin per diem for living in her Wasilla home and working out of the Anchorage governor's office. Since elected, Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell also has lived in Anchorage, working in Juneau when necessary. But when Parnell was in the legislature, his family moved to the capital city for the 120-day legislative sessions. That's when children were young. Now he says he needs to be flexible.
We have a daughter who is a senior in high school coming up, who has several classmates she's had with her since kindergarten. So I'm going to be splitting my time between Juneau and Anchorage this year.
As a parent, I can understand that.
That's Juneau Representative Kathy Munoz. All three Juneau and other Southeast legislators, like Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman, were hoping Parnell would move bag and baggage into the governor's house.
I'm confident that he'll reside in Juneau, where the governor should reside.
Governor Palin has distinguished herself by being the only Alaska governor to not reside in the state capital. That's one reason, says House Minority Leader Beth Kurtula, that Palin's relationship with the legislature has been rocky at best.
You know, 90% of life is just showing up.
Several standoffs between lawmakers and the governor this past session may have been avoided if they'd both been working in the Capitol building.
just your presence alone sometimes can calm things down. You can understand things, of course. And then, you know, if you want to be negotiating, you really can't come in at the last minute and try to put together a deal. It just doesn't work that way with us.
Especially with the new 90-day session.
If you're not around, you're going to miss the key moment. The governor needs to be in the capital city, and the commissioners need to be in it.
Only three commissioners in the Palin administration live in the state capital. Two are in Fairbanks and the rest in Anchorage. A number of other high-ranking state jobs have moved north. Between 2006 and 2008, about 90 were shifted out of the capital, most during the Palin administration. Representative Munoz says she's already had a conversation with Parnell on the subject.
I want to encourage him to be in Juneau and to bring the commissioners back to Juneau and to hire Southeast people when possible to fill those positions.
Parnell says he's planning a seamless transition and is not making any changes. Before Governor Knowles, cabinet members moved to the capital city. Two commissioners under Knowles were allowed to live in Anchorage, but it created much angst among lawmakers and Juneau residents. The difference, says Deputy Mayor Bush.
The focus remained here in Juneau, and the governor stayed here in Juneau.
At the beginning of his term, Governor Murkowski was adamant that commissioners live in the capital, with the exception of Military and Veterans Affairs, headquartered at Fort Richardson. But by the end of the Murkowski administration, several commissioners were living elsewhere. While Murkowski distinguished himself as the traveling gov, the governor's house in Juneau was his primary residence. Bush says Palin's absence has made it difficult for Juneau to portray itself as the state capital.
With the governor not here, we've had a hard time keeping the focus of the capital here in Juneau. There's been almost an acceptance by the government that Juneau is no longer the focus in their mind.
Capital creep, as it's been called, not only has a psychological effect, it also has an economic one. According to a recent McDowell Group report, for every state job lost in Juneau, about three-quarters of a job is lost in the support sector. For a city that has battled capital move efforts for 50 years, it's no wonder Juneau residents want to know where Governor Palin's replacement will live. They may have to wait until 2010. Parnell says he plans to run for governor then.
If I was elected to a four-year term, I would certainly commit to being in Juneau and living in Juneau full-time.
The field of gubernatorial candidates next year is likely to be large, and Juneau voters will probably hold every one to the traditional standard of living and working in the capital city. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
This month, U.S. Senate Democrats got another colleague in Minnesota, Senator Al Franken, which pushed them to the supermajority number of 60. That's how many votes it takes to shut down a filibuster. There are now technically 58 Democrats and two independents who caucus with them. But exactly what the impact will be of the Democrats' supermajority is up in the air. Alaska's Democratic Senator Mark Begich says it could be useful in shutting down Republican-led filibusters on occasion, but he says mostly Democrats march to the tune of their own drums. He says it may end up giving moderate Democrats like himself more power since they'll be the swing vote in the party.
If you listen to the Republican leadership of their political arm, what they're saying is 60 is dangerous to the country. Well, that's your assumption is that all 60 of us, you know, walk off, you know, onto issues all the same way. We don't. And so that's an assumption that really doesn't work. But the higher it gets to 60, the more capacity the moderate Democrats have to forge elements of the agenda.
However, Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says being a moderate Democrat is not an enviable position right now.
There's a lot of expectations on the Democrats now that you've got 60, you can make this happen. I don't think I would want to be a moderate Democrat in this Congress with these big ticket items that we have in front of us.
Murkowski and Begich both say at this point they don't see the Democrats' gain of a 60th seat having a dramatic impact on Alaska issues. John Katz, the director of the state's Washington, D.C. office, says many of today's hot-button topics are falling along regional rather than party lines.
I can't think of any Alaska issues at the moment where there's going to be
a neat compilation of 60 Democratic votes. The issues facing Alaska and Congress right now are pretty complicated: climate change, energy policy, healthcare reform, various other bills of similar ilk.
Katz says there are some issues that will likely break down along party lines with only a few defectors, including confirmation votes and issues like the economic stimulus package.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Work is getting underway on new homes for some Eagle residents displaced by this spring's record flooding. Eagle Recovery Team Leader Andy Basich says the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, has released funds to 13 local families who lost their houses. He says each homeowner is receiving $30,300. The money is being pooled for a group buy of log cabin kits out of sawmills in Tok. Basich says the national aid group Samaritan's Purse has agreed to provide additional $10,000 assistance grants.
It became very clear that the $30,300 wasn't going to be enough to cover everything that the people needed to rebuild the homes, even with additional free labor done through volunteers. So Samaritan Purse kind of huddled up and they came to the table and immediately offered the $10,000 per home grant.
He says the money can be used for essential things like electrical, sewer, and water systems. Eagle connected with Samaritan's Purse and another faith-based group, the Mennonite Disaster Service, through FEMA.
We have a tremendous partnership going on right now between Samaritan's Purse, who's bringing in both crews, money, and equipment to Eagle to support our rebuilding effort, and the Mennonite Disaster Service, which will be bringing up 12 highly skilled carpenters, craftsmen from the lower 48, and they are dedicating these crews for the entire summer.
The Mennonite and Samaritan's Purse organizations already have people in town setting up work camps in anticipation of starting the new cabins soon. Site preparation is the first step, and a lot of gravel needs to be hauled in. Basich says he's feeling optimistic about meeting a September 10th goal for getting all 13 cabins done. The replacement of another 18 homes destroyed by flooding remains in question due to assistance qualifications issues. He says some of those affected were not primary residences, or there are ownership questions.
We have quite a few people in the Eagle area that come in for subsistence activities in the summertime. We also have a number of people that come for their summers. They're not necessarily retirement homes, but they're people that own property or homes, and they come for the summers here. There's also one family that we're really concerned about, and it's a young family with kids, and they were in a situation where they were caretaking and they didn't actually have deed to the house that they were living in.
Basich says if the family isn't covered, there'll be an effort to raise money to build them a house. The recent deaths of seven homeless men over a two-month period drew dozens to an Anchorage meeting Friday afternoon, where professionals and members of the public sought solutions for a growing problem. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
By the time the two-hour meeting started, it was standing room only. Nearly a dozen health and social service professionals, police and fire department representatives sat in front behind a table that stretched across the room. The mood varied from hopeful to frustrated. Anchorage Fire Chief Craig Goodridge said in a way he hated being there. He's participated in meetings on the city's homeless for 40 years. He said it's a problem growing faster than the progress we've been making. The co-chair of the Anchorage Coalition on Homelessness, Trevor Storrs, said while individual groups were doing fine work, the challenges required a change in philosophy.
We keep saying it's a community issue, but we don't talk about community solutions. We need to change our mindset, quit thinking about dealing with the problem at the end, and let's deal with it at the beginning, prevention. And also recognize this is a chronic issue. It's like many other chronic issues or diseases that we deal with. They don't vanish once you take a magic pill.
The meeting moved between two segments of the city's homeless population. For the vast majority of homeless, their plight has more economic than personal causes. According to city officials, last January they numbered about 3,000 and often included families. That's up about a third from a similar tally in 2008. The average homeless age in Anchorage is 9 years old. The major focus on Friday was the more visible minority, the chronic street and illegal camp folks, many suffering from alcoholism, substance addiction, or mental illness. Their number is difficult to determine, but agency and city tallies place it somewhere around 200. That number also is rising. Anchorage Police Chief Rob Hune says it's a relatively small group that absorbs considerable department resources.
We spend about 10,000 police hours a year engaged with the homeless chronic inebriates. We spent over $4 million in dealing with chronic inebriate problems back in 2007.
Fire Chief Goodridge added another $1.3 million for community service patrols, plus the man down runs his emergency staff make.
Dozens of times a day we go on these calls, but only a half dozen times a year does this turn out to be an individual who really is in critical need of emergency services care.
According to the police, of the 7 deaths in May and June, the medical examiner's final reports in 4 of the 5 involved alcohol. 2 reports are pending. Hune said foul play was not involved in any of them. The panel was asked, would housing have prevented the 7 deaths? Maggie Carey, Beans Cafe social service director, offered a personal observation.
There's more drinking and dysfunction goes on, and they become more separated from the broader community. They would be in better shape if they were in housing. My observation when they come in from camping is they're in pretty rough shape.
Connie Marcus, a nurse at the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, cited a supporting study.
People that are housed with these problems do get better as a result of being in housing, and that's part of the tenet of the Housing First program, that you don't wait until somebody gets sober before you put them in a house.
Some suggested establishing a municipality-run tent city for those who wanted to avoid a housing program. Kristen Schmidt works with Rural Alaska Community Action Program's Housing First. One of her clients was among the 7 who died. Schmidt said Housing First didn't ultimately help the man. His illness was too severe. But the program has benefited others.
I have people who have been homeless for years, 15 years plus, and they've now been housed for over a year. So I hope that we can find more funding for everything.
The danger faced by the chronic homeless was underscored this Sunday evening when police announced they are investigating another man's death in Northeast Anchorage. In this case, police say it looks like foul play may have been involved. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/CEM. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.